This is All of It. I'm Kusha Navidar in for Allison Stewart, and thanks for spending part of your Wednesday with us. I'm glad you're here. On today's show, we'll talk about the history of Brooklyn's newly reopened Paramount Theater with that borough's historian. The recording artist No-No Boy is here to preview his upcoming show at Joe's Pub, and we'll talk about the best bars in New York City and take your suggestions. Really excited about that one. That's all coming up, so let's get this started with Top Chef's Gail Simmons. If you watch reality TV, hey, if you watch TV at all, you've probably seen Top Chef. The beloved cooking show just started its 21st season, and my next guest has been with the series from the very beginning. It was nearly two decades ago when food writer, author, and Top Chef judge Gail Simmons took a leap and joined the judging panel. Back then, reality TV was finding its way. Cooking shows looked more like Julia Child's teaching you to make an omelet, not a group of talented chefs competing in quick-fire challenges and sharing their own stories. 20 years later, Top Chef has gone across the globe and launched careers. And one cool thing about Top Chef is how it's been a window into the world of fine dining that's always evolving, which is something I hope we can talk about. In season 21, you'll see a new group of talented chefs head to Wisconsin to compete for glory and $250,000. New episodes premiere on Bravo on Thursday nights, and I am thrilled to be joined now to discuss Top Chef with Judge Gail Simmons. Hi, Gail.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Congrats on 21 seasons.
Thank you very much. You know, every time I hear it, it's just such a, it's a reality check. It really is. 21 seasons.
A reality TV check.
A reality TV check. Almost 20 years of my life. Like, really, the better part of my adult life has been spent on this show. I am very old.
What a huge accomplishment. Very wise. And hey, listeners, there has been 21 seasons for you to have consumed. I'm sure there's a lot of people listening right now that have watched many of those seasons. So our phones are open. What's your favorite season or moment of Top Chef? What's something you learned about cooking or about global cuisine from watching Top Chef? Or maybe you have a question about how things work behind the scenes. We're talking all things Top Chef. So call us or text us. Here's the number, 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. So, Gail, you've been with the show since it began.
Yes,
in
day one, episode one.
What were the initial goals when the show first began? What was the vision for what it could be?
That's a great question. Original goals. Well, if you go back to 2005 and think about the state of television, it's hard to put ourselves back there because television has evolved and reality television in particular has changed so much in 19 years. Reality television was in its infancy. There were no streamers, right? Maybe I was getting Netflix DVDs. I don't even know if I was, to be honest. And there was the Food Network. There were cooking shows, but as you referenced, they were mostly teaching you to cook. The only food competition, to my knowledge, in existence at the time was Iron Chef Japan, mm-hmm. the original Japanese version, which I loved and miss.
Same.
So I think the original goals of the show, you know, when it launched on Bravo, we shot it at the end of 2005. It aired in 2006. Was coming off of the success of Project Runway, actually. Mm-hmm. If you remember and think of the format, I mean, Project Runway obviously still in the air too. The format of Project Runway was very similar. And when it debuted the year before, Bravo realized that that formula was working and that they wanted to roll it out into what were at the time the other pillars of what Bravo worked on. They had five pillars, which were actually back then loosely based on the five original Queer Eye for the Straight Guy guys, the Fab Five.
Yeah.
So there was fashion, mm-hmm. food, pop culture, design, and beauty.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had taken on fashion with Project Runway, and they were going to now take that same formula for a competition show and move it to food. Bravo didn't know much about food, had never really done a food show. The only food content they had was Ted Allen's original role on Queer Eye as the food guy. And I think they just wanted to make a show about discovering talent, young talent, real talent, professional cooks who were just sort of getting started in their careers the way that Project Runway had done. And so those were the original goals. The original reality concept, though, was far more exaggerated, right? Back then, being a judge meant you had to sort of be like the villain or the nice one, the Paula or the Simon. And it was all about the drama, both in the kitchen, in the dining room, back at the house.
So I got to ask listeners, do you remember watching any of those early seasons, or do you remember Bravo back then? What was your relationship like with Top Chef? Our phones are open. Give us a call. We're talking all things Top Chef. It's just starting its 21st season. It's really exciting. Here's the number to call us or text us, 212-433-9692. It's 212-433-WNYC. And Gail, you know, you're talking about that original vision being something for Bravo to help discover young talent. How about for you? When you were starting back then in 2006 on the show, what did you feel like you were signing up for? Where were you in your life?
Great question. What was I signing up for? Truthfully, I had absolutely no idea. I'll give you the context, though, because it wasn't out of the blue. I wasn't just like picked from oblivion. I had spent, a good part of my career to that, all of my career to that date, working in the food industry as a journalist and in food media. I had gone to culinary school. I had worked as a line cook. I had worked for, I grew up in Canada, in Toronto, and I'd worked at a newspaper and then at a magazine and at a newspaper in Canada before moving to New York to go to culinary school and work as a cook so that I could get my skills up and understand the language of the kitchen because I knew I wanted to write about it. After I'd spent some time in kitchens in New York City, I went to work for a food critic, the food critic at Vogue magazine, Jeffrey Steingarten. I was his assistant for 2 years. From there, I went to work for Danielle Boulou, an amazing icon of the food world, one of the greatest chefs in America, still living, still my fairy godfather. Worked for him. Building his business, I worked in public relations and events. I helped him write books and do all of his charity work and all his public relations work. And after 3 years with him, I got an offer to move to Food & Wine magazine, which was really the culmination for me, the pinnacle of what I wanted to do, right? It was putting all those pieces together, my cooking skills, my public relations skills, my writing skills, and finally I could go work for that glossy, beautiful publication that I dreamed about. Remember that back then in the aughts, food media really just meant those things, right? Food media mostly meant print media. Social media was in its infancy. There were blogs, but it was really a different time in the media landscape. And so the ultimate job was to land one of those jobs at a glossy food publication like Food & Wine, Bon Appetit, Gourmet at the time. And so when I had that chance to work at Food & Wine, I jumped, not even really knowing what my position was going to be. I took the job sort of sight unseen. And when I got there, I actually was running part of the marketing department at first. Within a year of being there, so that was 2004, by the middle of 2005, two major things happened. One, the woman who had left her job running Food & Wine's biggest event of the year, the Food & Wine Classic in Aspen, left and just to go on maternity leave and decided not to return. So I was offered to move into her job. And almost simultaneously, Food & Wine got a call from Bravo. They didn't know much about the food world, but they were going to sort of leap into this next iteration of this television formula. And they needed a food partner who could teach them about food media, teach them about chefs, and partner with them on the marketing of the show to make it legitimate in the food world. And if they found an editor who they liked, they would put them on the show to represent the magazine. So they sent me for a screen test.
And so it's kind of like right place, right time, with
Absolutely.
A lot of runway leading up to that plane taking off, which is wild. We've got a caller on line one, Amy in Bloomfield, New Jersey. Hi, Amy. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi,
Amy. First time caller, long time listener. Hey, Gail, how are you?
Thank you. I'm great. Thank you for calling.
You're welcome. So I would have to say that I literally have been watching Top Chef since the very first season. I've followed the careers of a lot of the chefs. We've also always make a point if we're in a certain city to try to go to a restaurant that a Top Chef is running. And I wait with bated breath every season for the first episode to start. I was so excited last week. And also, I think I've become a much better home chef because of it. I cook different meals almost every night. It's like a restaurant in my house.
You're a poster child. Thank you very much for helping me keep my job.
Amy, thank you so much for that call. We've got another caller, Charlotte in Jersey City. Hey, Charlotte, welcome to the show.
Hi. I have to say I'm kind of the opposite, but I'm jealous of the first caller because I've never gone to anybody's restaurants or anything. But I have been watching Top Chef all over again, starting about a month and a half ago.
Oh, wow.
The first season. So I'm seeing Gail way back
Oh,
when,
yeah. I was a baby. I mean, don't put too much value to my hairstyles. Remember, it was 19 years ago. We've all evolved.
Well, you should see all. You should go back and look at all the blooper reels.
Yeah, I'm
That's
good.
Very interesting to see.
Thank
but,
you.
sure. Anyway, it's really fun. I love it. I do it while I sew. I can watch it and sew at the same time.
Yes, I love
it's
that.
It's just my go-to. Oh, so great.
Charlotte,
thank you
so much for calling. What a wonderful way to kick things off, just hearing that reflection. And Gail, you know, you listen to these folks who say, I've been watching for a long time. The show has evolved over those years.
Absolutely.
If you watch the early seasons of the show, there's a lot more emphasis on like traditional high cuisine, I guess, French cooking, elevated mm-hmm. technique. How has the focus of the show and the criteria you're using to judge changed over the course of 21 seasons?
It's changed a lot. I mean, we play this chicken and egg game all the time with the show when we talk about the direction that it goes in, the challenges, the chefs who we cast, because it's hard to differentiate at this point. Did we change the popular culture of cooking, or did we evolve because of how the world was changing? And I actually think it's a little bit of both.
Mm.
The show has evolved enormously in terms of the people we cast, the quality of cooking, the way we do our challenges, the emphasis on cooking. It used to have a lot more emphasis on the sort of reality beats, the drama outside the kitchen. We have cut so much of that out. We learned very quickly that our audience wants to watch professionals do what they do at the highest level. And so the cooking is the drama, right? Mm. We don't need all that other stuff. And that stuff kind of fell to the wayside in the evolution of reality television anyway. We don't need to make it about drama or being a villain. There's enough drama in the kitchen with the stakes that we give them to begin with and hearing their stories and understanding sort of the narrative of all these amazing characters, because they are true professionals, but they are so diverse, so interesting that has been, I think, a big evolution, right? There used to be a more limited pool only because that's what we thought the world wanted. And we now know also the opportunity for a more diverse cast has evolved, thankfully, so much too. And so the world used to think that Western European cooking was the be-all, end-all, was haute cuisine, was the standard, but we now know and understand so much more about regional cooking, about diverse cooking, about the immigration pathways of how we want to eat and how we want to expand our palates and learn about other cuisines and call on those people who are cooking from their heritage and their origins.
We're talking to Gail Simmons, who's a Top Chef judge. The series is on its 21st season. It airs on Bravo on Thursday nights. Listeners, we're getting calls about your experience with the show Top Chef. There's almost 20 years of content to go through. I'm sure some of you have very deep relationships with this. So what's something you learned about cooking or about global cuisine from watching Top Chef? Or maybe you have a question for Gail. We're talking all things Top Chef. Give us a call or text us 212-433-9692. It's 212-433-WNYC. We'll hear more about the history of the show, what to expect this season, and we'll take your calls right after a quick break. This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Kusha Navidar, and we're talking to Gail Simmons from the show Top Chef. She's a judge. We're on our 21st season of Top Chef. New episodes air on Bravo on Wednesday nights. And listeners, we want to invite you into this conversation. What's your favorite season or moment from Top Chef? And do you have a favorite contestant from the past few years? What questions do you have for Gail? Give us a call or text us 212-433-9692. And Gail, before the break, we were talking about how the show has evolved and how the cuisine industry in general has evolved. And I think sexism is an important topic to touch on. One thing you can also notice from earlier seasons is, you know, female chefs having a difficult time proving themselves to their male counterparts, men making sexist comments to the female contestants. You see this in a lot of reality TV from that era in general. How do you think the industry, the food and wine industry, has changed when it comes to sexism?
In some ways, enormously. In some ways, we have a very far way to go. You know, an interesting piece is that, you know, I worked as a cook before I was on this show, before I ever was making television. And I'm not going to say that it was so much different in kitchens, right? The culture of kitchens has changed. The culture of kitchens is still largely male. The same way there's, I mean, when you are a cook, not necessarily chef, but being a cook on the line of a busy restaurant is physical labor. And so it is largely still a male-dominant industry. And that's a fact. I'm not going to argue otherwise. I think the percentage of women to men overall in professional kitchens now is still under 20%. And so we have a long way to go, but we have evolved enormously. I'm talking about the industry. Our show actually always reflected a better ratio regardless. Our show from day one was always 50% male, 50% female, regardless of what the true reflection of the industry might have been, because we wanted to elevate and promote that gender, you know, opportunity. And we have made our cast always incredibly diverse, and even more so in the last decade, let's say. But there is, and I think that the kind of culture has changed a lot in restaurants also because of transparency, because of Me Too, because of social media, because we now can look back and realize just how toxic some of those cultures were. Not all, though. You know, not every kitchen was a pit of despair.
Yeah. Are there, when you think back to those early seasons, or maybe even something more recently, is there a female chef who you think has really been a trailblazer? Does anyone come to mind that you think is making a big difference in the food industry right now?
I mean, in the industry, there's amazing women doing incredible things. And there's so many more now than there were when I was a young cook. I wish I'd had more female mentors, truthfully. But that doesn't mean they're not there and now are being given more opportunity. You know, the truth is, it is a question of funding and economic opportunity for women and people of color. It is still harder in this industry for a woman or a person of color, and certainly if you are both, to gain funding, get investors. And get, and even if you can get investors, get the same kind of investment, whether that's a known or sort of subconscious bias, it's problematic and it is a systemic issue in the industry. But I do actually have to say, and our recent caller confirmed this, that there is a piece of Top Chef I'm really proud of, because I think in a really macro way, we have changed the economics of the industry. We have brought so many more women and people of color to a platform. What they do with it is their choice, and so many of them have done great things, but we have given them a platform that they might not have always had. And, you know, in particular, women of color who have been on our show, and just women in general who've gone on. I think about some of our winners and finalists, Carla Hall, Kristen Kish, Mae Lynn, Melissa King, you know, and on, I mean, I could go on, Tiffany Derry. There's so many extraordinary women, Brooke Williamson, Antonia LaFaso, I mean, dozens and dozens, if not hundreds at this point, of women and people of color who I think, you know, who have changed the economics of the industry.
And what you're describing is really a platform that you've created for folks to launch off of into a higher sphere of their career.
Correct.
We're getting a bunch of calls, so let's go take a few in a row. Mary from Morristown, New Jersey. Hi, Mary. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I remember watching Top Chef. It was a long time ago. It may have been a marathon prior to Thanksgiving, that where there was a chef that still has some notoriety with a very heavy Italian accent. And there was a woman on Chef who every challenge she presented scallops of some kind. And I specifically remember him looking in the camera and saying, I think her name was Jamie, and saying, Jamie, this is Top Chef, not Top Scallops.
I mean, if you want to know a little about Jamie, I'll tell you this. Jamie, who I love with all my heart, you know, native New Yorker, now is out in L.A., but she is now the culinary director of our show.
Wonderful.
And yes, that was the scallop season. There were a lot of scallops that season, and a few seasons, actually. I can't remember who the chef was that you're referring to, but I will say that Jamie's also gone on to do amazing things and is like one of my favorite people.
Thank you so much for the call. Let's go to Kate in Brooklyn. Hi, Kate. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me. Yeah, and I actually have met Gail a long time ago. I worked on the NBC Universal Bravo side on the Charleston, Colorado, and Kentucky season.
Oh, wow.
And Yeah, on the sponsored integrations, which is not the show's favorite, but it's what, you know, I'm sure Gail
It keeps
knows
us alive.
About.
I have a lot of respect for what you do, because I will say, and actually just as a side note, I think all of the integrations we do on the show, I mean, it's the reality of making television. It's a business endeavor. It has to get paid for. We can be transparent about that. But also, I think Top Chef was one of the first and has been really trailblazing at doing integrations that are organic. And even when they're not, we talk about them openly. And we have done really smart, funny, appropriate things with them. And so we all really understand how that works. And I think our audience does too.
So let's go to Sarah in Brooklyn. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to speak to you both. Gail, I was wondering, how often do the judges on Top Chef disagree? And how do you guys reconcile your disagreement and decide who to eliminate?
You know, it happens. Yeah, it happens often. I wouldn't say that we disagree. I think it's a strong word. I don't think there's ever necessarily a time where someone thinks something is amazing and someone else thinks it's terrible, because there is a standard objectively of proper cooking that we all understand. There is just nuance. And so we all come to the table literally with different points of view. And so there's always a very lively and honest discussion at the judge's table, which, by the way, takes 3 to 5 hours, not the 7 minutes that you see it edited down to on camera. How we reconcile our differences, our disagreements, or our different points of view is manyfold. First of all, it is a 4-person, if not 5-person judges table for a reason, right? It's not a dictatorship. Not one person makes that decision. Because we all have different points of view, and because there are at least 4 of us every time talking it out, we have to all get there, come to an agreement that we all are comfortable with before they let us up from judges table. There are times when our producers may have made us sit there until the roosters start crowing and it's the wee hours of the morning, because we can't walk away without fully feeling comfortable across the board with the decisions we make. So how we reconcile is that we talk it out. And sometimes that's a long conversation, and sometimes it's just me convincing or making a good, valid argument for why I think one person is just a hair better than the other. More times than not, it's the nuances of a dish, not the broad strokes, that are the differentiating points.
This brings up an interesting point for me about conveying food on reality TV, because, you know, you mentioned those 5 pillars before the break that Bravo was focusing on. When you look at fashion or modeling, or look at other reality shows like singing, if I'm the viewer, I can make assessments for myself. Oh, this person's a good singer. That dress looks really nice. But you show me risotto, and I don't know how it tastes. And so that makes you, as the host, a really important proxy. How do you convey that information to somebody who can't be there? And how do you do it in a way that seems to make this genre of reality TV still so compelling?
This is my favorite question. Mostly because we are always working on it, and it's always a conversation with our producers and at the table every day on our show. We feel a lot of responsibility. And the truth is, we understand that we are the literal taste buds of our audience. It is not like singing or fashion where you can see it, you can hear it, you can judge for yourself sitting on your couch. You only know what we give you on the show. So if mine and Tom and Kristen and our guest judge, if we are not honest and clear in our description and our analysis, then the viewer changes the channel, turns off, doesn't trust us, especially because they are so invested in these people, right? The show is about these chefs and their journeys and their struggles and their stories. And if we are flippant or if we aren't clear in our descriptions, then the viewer is on the side of the chef and just is angry at us. So we need to be authentic. We need to have real conversations. And we need to learn how to talk about food in ways that sort of break it down to the audience, not just to the chef. So I always say, like, you know, whereas Tom and Kristen, to some extent, because she obviously was a winner of a season and is a professional chef herself.
And these are judges on the show.
Our other judges, correct. You know, our new host, Kristen and Kish and Tom Colicchio, who is, you know, my partner in crime of 21 seasons. They speak to the chefs as if the chefs are cooks in their kitchen. You know, at the start of service or at the end of service every night, how did things go? Did it go well? Will you be promoted? Will you be lauded? Did it go badly? Will you be scolded or fired or whatever the story is? I, on the other hand, am not a professional chef. I live among them, but I am not one of them. I've spent my career on the other side of the table, and I feel like my role is more of a translator. I'm taking that chefy language that they're discussing, and I'm translating it for our viewers into a language that they can understand. And, you know, it is up to all four of us to describe the food in better ways than, for example, saying this risotto is amazing. By the way, the risotto is never amazing. But whatever it is, this piece of fish is amazing. Well, that doesn't tell you anything, right? Mm-hmm. So my job as a writer, when I'm writing, it's the same with any writer. And then also, of course, even more so when you're on camera, is to describe it in terms, and our producers are always reminding us, but what does it taste like? Is it sweet? Is it sour? Is it too salty? Is it too raw? What are those descriptors? What are those ways of framing the dish so that when you're at home, you understand even if you don't agree?
Watching it through that lens, I bet, would add a lot of texture to the ways that the production and the story unfolds, I bet. We've got time for just two more quick calls. Let's take Joe in Scarsdale. Hi, Joe. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on. That's actually that part of the conversation is a good segue into my comment, which is basically I want to applaud you for casting Kristen Kish.
Yes.
She's a wonderful person. Obviously, she's awesome. I actually got to know her a little bit. It's not a random story, but it's our story. I have Korean adopted kids. It was during COVID, and I was coordinating in a camp, and it's a camp for like 100 adopted Korean kids. And Kristen is kind of a cult hero among our groups, and many Korean American kids. Mm-hmm. And I reached out to her, and literally within 15 minutes, she replied to my Instagram message, and she said, "Where do I show up?" Mm-hmm. And I spoke to her before then. And she spent like an hour or two, and she was only supposed to spend like 45 minutes. The point of the story is that she is such a fantastic person, and she knows her stuff. And importantly, and this goes dovetails with your previous comment, is she's a very good communicator in regards to teaching people not only how to cook, but what it means and what the flavors are and, you know, whatever. And I am just rooting for her to be a star.
She's already a star, and I think you get it. Incredibly empathetic human being.
Joe, thank you so much for that call. And Daniel from Queens. Hi, Daniel. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Gail. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
I like a previous caller, I am rewatching the show from the beginning. I think I'm on season 9 right now. And a challenge I watched recently was the barbecue challenge at the Salt Lick.
Oh, yes.
Where they did a whole Drama. Overnight cook. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and I think Sarah was the contestant's name, went to the hospital. My question is about these challenges with sometimes unreasonable expectations. I mean, people who make barbecue know that you can smoke a brisket for more than 24 hours, and you're asking them to do it in 12 or 16. And is that, are those challenges designed that way for drama, like by the producers, or do you feel like you actually get sort of impressive results out of these chefs when they're under, you know, unreasonable conditions?
Well, first of all, I want you to finish watching up to season 21. And the pattern, the trajectory, I think you'll see is that we stop doing those challenges a little bit. I'm not saying that we don't put them into very intense challenges and have very high expectations and are constantly pushing ourselves to be creative with what we expect them to do. But we don't do overnight challenges anymore. To my knowledge, I can't really remember exactly the last time. And we did one, I remember, in Colorado where they were camping. But even then, they could have slept. I mean, it wasn't the same thing. So I think you've seen a trend and you're spotting how the show has evolved a little bit in terms of our expectations. But my answer is sort of both, I think. We design things because remember that it's not – any television show is not just about the end result. It's about how we got there. And so we need to push them and make story and make it interesting. And we want to see who can be creative. I mean – to reference that Colorado episode where we sent them camping, it was May and there was a foot of snow. Unexpected. But one contestant, Carrie, built an oven and baked dessert. So it is sort of that, you know, the mother of invention.
Necessity is
the mother of invention. And we have seen extraordinary things. Mm. Think about the people who've come out of these seasons and what they've accomplished. I mean, you think about Sarah in season 9. Yeah, she did go to the hospital. That wasn't a great moment for us because we didn't want that. And we've moved away from things like that happening again. But Sarah made it to the finals, now runs one of the best restaurants in Chicago. She's a superstar. Mm. And I think any contestant will tell you that being on the show is the hardest work they've ever done in their life, but in hindsight, also the most rewarding.
We'll have to leave it there. So if you would like to see that hard work at play, you can check out new episodes of season 21 of Top Chef on Bravo on Wednesday nights. We were joined by Gail Simmons, who's a Top Chef judge. Gail, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for chatting.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.